The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for Vampire's Kiss from 1988. If you do not wish to have this movie spoiled, please watch it before listening to the following podcast. Is it an extremely focused performance by an exceptional actor, or is Nicolas Cage straight up crazy? We watched Vampire's Kiss from 1988 to see if we could redeem it. Were we successful? Find out after the theme.
Boy? Oh boy.
Is it too good to be bad? So bad it's good. What's this? Do you think we should? It's got bad I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy?
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project Redeeming Features cast, this time looking at Vampire's Kiss from 1988. I am one of your hosts, Trevor Holland, and I am joined by my good friend and co-host,
Christian Fletcher, back as always. Thank you very much for welcoming me back, Trevor. So, as always, we say the movies might not be very good, but the chats always are.
Absolutely. And, you know, after every movie, you know, after I suggested or you suggested, there's always the question about, you know, whether one of us are going to want to come back, but we keep on doing it to ourselves so that we can share the experience with everybody else out there.
Definitely. And in many cases, it probably might even stop these people from having to endure some of these movies. They might actually just have to listen to our chat instead. So hopefully we've forewarned you about a few, but you know, we're not too sure how we're going to go with Vampire's Kiss. It might be the exception for, because I think this year so far we haven't redeemed any from memory.
That's right. We've done two so far, and we've had to admit defeat in trying to redeem them so far. So we'll see how we go with this Nicolas Cage vehicle, I suppose you could say, from 1988.
It was interesting. I think when you first suggested it, I was thinking it was very, very early in his career, but I think he'd already had about sort of 10 to 15 movies under his belt by this stage. So I was actually really surprised by that. So, I wasn't too familiar with this movie. Like, I'd heard of it, but, you know, now that I'm seeing that, you know, it was a box office failure and regarded now as a cult film and all that kind of stuff. But I, I was probably thinking most of the time I was watching it, I was watching a a debut performance, possibly, but I had to go and check that afterwards.
Yeah, well, I'll touch on that, I suppose, when we get to the trivia and stuff. But what we probably should do first up is let everyone out there know what Vampire's Kiss is about, and I've dug up this synopsis for it. After a night of passionate lovemaking in which he is bitten on the neck, a troubled literary editor becomes convinced he is a vampire and begins to live the role.
I think that could sum it up quite well, and I think that was probably what I went in knowing we were going to get, and possibly not expecting, again, not giving away too much, but not expecting the performance that Nicolas Cage was going to put in. Again, coming at this thinking it was his debut performance, I was quite shocked, admittedly. So, but yeah, I think that nails it on the head, hits the nail on the head, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, we'll get into some turkey trivia so we can talk turkey about the potential turkey and go into some of the trivia. It's rated 5.9 out of 10 on IMDb. This movie had a budget of $2 million and it ended up taking about $725,000. So fairly small budget by movie standards, but comparatively, that's one heck of a flop.
Oh, especially when, you know, in 1988, it probably would have still got quite a mainstream release. I don't know, or unless they decide to be limited run. But, you know, and as we said a couple of weeks ago, you know, it's good to see the MGM line. You know, admittedly, that was at the start there. But I suppose MGM being a quite a major company, yeah, to release a film like this. But, yeah, that is very bad for a movie not even to scrape the $1 million mark.
Yeah, well, when you consider it, it probably would have got pretty major lease, because you mentioned a few times, you know, that you thought this was almost like a premiere movie or an introducing Nicolas Cage movie. But if you look at what he's done before this, I mean, you had Valley Girl, He was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, The Cotton Club, Birdie, Peggy Sue Got Married, Raising Arizona, and Moonstruck, all of which he gets really good press for. And, you know, and everyone basically says, you know, that he's really good in all these movies, and all of those occur and are released before we get to Vampire's Kiss.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because even as you're saying those titles, I'm like, that's right, he was in that too. Oh, yeah! So, and I think it was just interesting, because I suppose it probably fits in with the whole vampire theme too, but he just seems to never age. I was laughing as I watched this going, he actually has aged really well, so maybe I just always saw him as this eternal guy, I don't know. But, yeah, interesting to see that it was placed where it was. But hey, they weren't necessarily going to have a he wasn't going to have a hit film all the way through, and I think some of even those other titles you mentioned probably had very rocky releases as well. But Vampire Kiss definitely stands out as being possibly an odd one to come along at the time that it did.
Yeah, absolutely. But just probably touching on what most people may be familiar from this movie, even if they've never actually seen this movie, is there is a meme with Nicolas Cage looking quite crazy with a big bug-eyed expression. And so that popular image was taken from a still frame from this movie in the scene where Cage's character is telling the secretary, Elva, that she is the lowest employee on the totem pole. And during the entire scene, his face just gets more and more into this bizarre expression that that you still see attached to many Nicolas Cage memes to this day.
Well, I remember you even saying to me during the week that, I think I saw your post, you know, that it's, it has a lot of memes about it. And I thought even as I was watching it, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is perfect fodder for Cageites to be able to put memes together. So it was almost like he did that performance for it. But, so obviously our listeners are getting that Nicolas Cage's performance was a bit iffy, but I was actually really surprised that he didn't get a Raspberry Award for this. I even actually had to look that up. But he must have had some worse performances that year. So, but yeah, definitely the bug-eyed expression sums it up pretty well. And it was really interesting in there just to sort of move on, was to see Jennifer Beals from Flashdance, because she was always sort of, I don't know, she's never really been a very big actress in terms of, it was almost like that was a sort of only sort of big thing she did. I think she might have been in terms of Demon or one of those films as well. But yeah, seeing her in sort of, this is probably the only other film aside from Flashdance that I'd seen her in, so just mentioning somebody else that I noticed in it. And yeah, it's probably the only cast members that I sort of recognised.
Yeah, well, mentioning Jennifer Beals, basically this movie, and there was an earlier film that she did just before this called The Bride, and with that she achieved the distinction of having played both a female vampire and the Bride of Frankenstein in back-to-back movies.
Oh, that's quite interesting. It'd be interesting if it was in the same movie, but that might be a stretch to her acting talents. So, but yeah, so I suppose when you're thinking about it, and in the context of the films that you were saying, you know, these people seem very very appropriate choices for this sort of late 80s vehicle, I suppose.
Probably the only other bit of trivia I've really got, and I've dug this up because I'm sure, I watched this movie. I watched it with my wonderful wife and co-host of What the History podcast, hit, sort of plug, Susie, and we're both thinking, what the hell is going on with Nicolas Cage's accent in this movie?
Oh, my God.
But it says here, the character's name is Peter Lowe, and it's got here that Peter's strange accent is supposed to be a fake accent used by the character because he thinks he sounds more elegant and smarter, hence the literary agent job. The accent comes and goes throughout the movie and is more prominent when he's trying to impress people and less in scenes with people like his psychiatrist.
But it's like we didn't get the memo about that before we watched the movie. It's almost like sort of going into this character thing that it makes a lot more sense, but yeah, it was completely lost on me. Mm-hmm. That's actually the next note on my page, Trevor. Why was he changing accents throughout? I didn't know if it was just really bad acting or he just wasn't, I suppose that's the thing. The fact that he's being bitten by this vampire and doing crazy things, you kind of just added it in as, it's just another crazy thing happening.
Yeah, but he was doing the accent before he got bitten. But
that's right, he was too. That kind of does lead me into the fact that he was kind of a bit of a maniac before he even got bitten anyway. So it was almost like his acting was it started at 11 and just kept getting higher.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, he is a method actor, and I suppose that's probably the only way you can describe what he did in this movie, but we are getting ahead of ourselves.
I know.
So, well, because we are so keen to get going through, I think we better set our baseline, if that's okay with you.
Yes, definitely.
And so this is where we start with a review that I suppose just to show where we're working from when it comes to redeeming the movie. So I head to Amazon and find some less than glowing reviews, and so we can start there. The title of this review is Good God, This Movie. This movie. Good God, this movie. No matter how much you think you and your friends love bad movies and will have a great time, you are not prepared for this level of anarchy. No words I can say will help you. If you're doing this, if you make the decision to inflict this upon yourself and those you love, just know that I've been where you are now, and in hindsight, I was wrong. I was horribly wrong. I regret and am ashamed of my decisions, mostly involving pressing play. Now, you must make your own choices. I won't judge you. I've said my piece. And we both know you're going to watch it anyways. But realize that you have and had a choice. And hopefully one day, after you make the wrong one, you'll recover. 1 star.
Oh, gosh, if I'd heard the line about inflicting this movie on others, Trevor, before I'd watched it, I might have had a few things to say. But, okay, yeah, that definitely is our 1 star review. So, yeah, it can only go up, sideways, or maybe backwards from here.
Yeah, absolutely. But as you mentioned before, again, anything that starts with the MGM lion, I mean, that's always a nice touch. It gives a nice classic feel.
It's just a shame that it goes like downhill from here. Sorry, Eva.
No, that's fine. But one thing I did notice about this movie, I mean, it goes for about 1 hour and 43, which, you know, isn't too bad a length. But a lot of times when you look at these sort of movies, you know, there's extended credit sequences at the start and the end. But this one doesn't waste any time on the titles.
Mm.
Our tour of New York rooftops with sinister music playing in the background, it's quite an interesting just start to the movie, and I don't know if it really sets the scene all that much, because once it gets started, there's not too much rooftop action.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, I don't know if you've seen the film The Hunger with David Bowie in it from the early 80s. And I suppose it's that's sort of what they call those sort of erotic or 80s, you know, horror sort of vampire films. But this, I don't know if this was trying to get that feel or spoof it. And it was just so hard to really know what it was doing. So I think that was one of those first things where I'm like, okay, you call vampires because you're going to start off quite ominous. But yeah, as you said, the rooftop thing didn't continue anymore. It was just almost like just an excuse to put something behind the opening credits.
Yeah, or just, you know, the whole, hey, look, we're in New York. We're going to show a whole pile of New York in a short space of time. And again, the Twin Towers are there, which is, yeah, still a rather strange thing to see in these older movies, even though, you know, they're there. Plenty of movies were shot back before those unfortunate events, but yeah, it still is rather odd seeing them there.
Oh, definitely. But I think, actually, you know, we were saying it doesn't waste any time getting into it, but I even felt there's such a thing as, you know, really bad openings to movies. And I felt that this, you know, for the first sort of 5 minutes or so, because we've got the sort of, I think we open in the psychologist's office or the psychiatrist's office, and then we're going straight to a club. And I felt that it didn't really waste any time getting into it, but it also didn't waste any time trying to confuse the hell out of us, not trying to build anything up. I don't know. It just wanted to try and get us to the, let's just say the bat scene. I'm not jumping ahead, but it's trying to get us to that or the scene with the vampire as soon as possible. But yeah, I've even got in my notes here, this is a really bad opening, and I'm thinking, God, 3 minutes in and I'm already going, uh-oh, there's another 1 hour 40 to go.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because, yeah, like I said, it starts in the psychiatrist's office, and he's saying that, you know, that he had a lady over, and he, like, yeah, didn't seem to like the morning after, and basically just started getting ready for work. to make her leave. But then it cuts back, yeah, to him in the club, picking up this woman and then walking out with overwrought laughter.
Oh, my God.
Accent.
Her laughing
God,
just...
That accent.
Oh, her laughing just annoyed me the whole time. It wasn't just a little giggle out of the club. It went out of the club, down the street, up the stairs, even in the stairwell. And then they had to have the... Like, the whole... Always in these movies, when people are creeping... Not creeping home, but people are making a noise coming home, there's always some kid on the stairs looking at them. And I thought, oh, of course. And of course, the... And then when she comes out a little bit later and she's half-dressed, of course, the kid's there. And then the mum yanks him out of the way. But I'm like, oh, it's been done in so many movies. But yeah, God, her laughing annoyed me. I was glad when she shut up.
but then they kept doing it, like, afterwards, like, you know, this bat flies through the window, and that camera angle from the window, that was so voyeuristic. It was just, I felt uncomfortable watching this scene as Nicolas Cage and this woman rather awkwardly get into drunken sexy time. And the shot from outside through the top of the window, I guess to show that the window was open. So when this bat that just turns up, this very fake looking
yes.
bat puppet starts being flopped around the room. So you can kind of just see, you know, how it got into his flat. And but the other thing I was wondering through this entire scene, and then it kind of cuts back to the psychiatrist's office, it was this Nicolas Cage recounting the events to his psychiatrist, or was it like two separate psychiatrist visits with this happening in the middle? I was just really trying to work that out.
Yeah, I wish I could give them credit for thinking that it was that good, but I actually don't think it's almost like it's really bad continuity. But I do know what you mean. It was very much okay. You've given me a whole new way to look at it. I was more thrown by the fact that they were stripping off to what I've got as here is very kind of scary, creepy music. They're having this, you know, they're getting in waste no time getting into the first sex scene, pretty much in the first sort of 5 minutes of the film. But the next thing, they're taking all their clothes off. The music's all this kind of ominous, sort of scary music, and it just sort of, again, it's like, are you trying to spoof the genre? Are you trying to be this actual serious erotic horror vampire film? So yeah, it was it's quite strange. But and then, you know, of course it wastes no time when the bat comes in.
Yeah, and when the bat gets under the curtains, like you mentioned, the sinister music, it goes up a notch when he's shaking the curtains, and mind you, he's also laughing at the same time. This is certainly a movie of conflicting between what you're seeing and hearing, let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah, but then I suppose, you know, looking at what he says to his psychiatrist after seeing the bat, he could have been thinking all sorts of thoughts. Now, I think, I don't know if it was straight after where he talks to the psychiatrist about essentially being turned on by the bat, and that's when it just goes into this whole new thing, and I'm like, well, maybe he was just laughing in ecstasy, I don't know.
Yeah, it was just very, very odd the way it progresses, and yeah, like I said, yeah, it cuts back to the psychiatrist, and then a bit more of the bat, and then they go off to have sexy time at the girl's place because the bat's still at his place, and then it's like the next day, and he's in the office, but he's obviously been out all night because he's got no socks on when he asks for, I'm just going to call it this every time, the contract.
Oh my gosh. One of those sort of plot devices, I suppose, that you think is going to be a throwaway, but ends up becoming the contract the whole way through. So yeah, very appropriate name for it. it's our first meeting for that, and his I suppose he's very the poor Alva, his secretary, she doesn't have much luck in this movie.
Yeah, and we'll get into it later, but yeah, just the way everything escalates, and I've got my own thoughts on that, obviously, that we can touch on as we go through the movie, but I mean, just initially, you know, he expresses concern that he can't find the contract he needs for his client, and suggests that some places that she can look for it, because he's already checked some other places. And yeah, it seems fairly mundane, even if said in that bizarre accent of his. And next thing you know, he's standing in a bar where everyone, it seems like everyone in the bar is laughing maniacally.
Sorry, because there's a couple of club scenes. I'm just trying to think if it's... I think it might be... Yeah, so yeah, it's the second one. Sorry, yeah, I'm just trying to remember where we're up to.
Yeah.
Because we did a couple of times when we stopped at the Dakota Club, sorry.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of... Just trying to think of it. It's like he's having drinks with some friends in this... Well, pretty more a bar than a club, and he doesn't seem to be paying too much attention to his two friends that are laughing maniacally. And so he goes across this bar... spots Jennifer Beale sitting there by herself,
right. Yes.
And walks past. There's like another couple that walks past and says something, and then they laugh maniacally. And he uses, "So did you get that joke?" as his chat up line, and things seem to move very fast.
Oh no,
him and Jennifer Beale from there.
Oh gosh, yeah, she doesn't. No, I think in most situations like that, the person will be like, "Oh gosh," like she doesn't even seem standoffish to him at all. She's straight into like, "Oh no," and like you're like, "Oh okay, well there's our leading lady." You know, doesn't waste any time. Yeah. She's not going to play hard to get, but I suppose because she knows her prey, I suppose, because I don't think it takes very long before she bites him. But I suppose it doesn't take him very long before he's onto the next girl. In the case of Jennifer Beers, I think her name is Rachel, I've got written here. So that'd be... Yeah, so he doesn't waste any time getting onto her as well.
Indeed. And yeah, so... And this is where I suppose it starts getting a bit... Yeah, because there's a big question mark as to whether or not, you know, she's an actual vampire. Because of you see a... So you see them chatting up, and then they're on the bed together, and she leans over and starts chowing down on his neck, and he's just there writhing around quite disturbingly in throes of ecstasy. Yeah. But the next morning, he's there, and after we hear that, you know, he can't wait to get the women out of his house, he's there making coffee and talking, and he goes and serves coffee to an empty bed and starts shaking ever so slightly. And you're still going, okay, so what happened? This is, and like, we don't actually see a band-aid on his neck until a bit later on after he cuts himself shaving.
Because I think that was the, yeah, that's right, because I, I think it's actually in the psychiatrist's office. They actually have the camera set exactly right on his band-aid. So, we, you know, make sure the audiences definitely see it. But yeah, as you said, it didn't happen until the, shaving.
And then, I mean, there's a few other times where he's, like, throughout the movie, there's a few instances where he's doing something like he's in the shower and he invites her into the shower and there's, like, again, no one there getting into the shower with him. And, like, yeah, multiple times he appears to be having conversations with mid-air being directed towards this vampire who we do see from time to time, usually just before... She, you know, goes to chow down on his neck again.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing, too, I suppose, because he's also hallucinating after the apparent bite, or, you know, it's also hard to sort of know if what we are seeing, yeah, is what he's hallucinating or is actually happening. Because I know there's a scene later on where he's... Oh, I'm trying to remember who he's speaking to. Speaking to the psychiatrist and his secretary? No, when he's on the street... But he's actually, you know, all covered in blood going, ah, but he's actually thinks he's in the psychiatrist's office or was it at work? I can't remember the actual situation. So it made me think that was kind of what could have been happening a lot through the whole time. We're actually just sort of seeing what he thinks he's seeing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you see it, if you look at it as there is no vampire, we're just watching someone having a rather manic and progressive breakdown throughout the movie, so I actually don't know what's scarier personally, and we haven't even got on to how he shows his increasing mania as the movie goes through.
Oh, he definitely does do it because he starts. This is when all the, you know, the hallucinating starts. But I think one of the first things I remember noticing was when he starts forgetting things, and they're all very much, you know, they're starting to see something's not quite right. But then with the way that Nick Cage is acting too, it's just it doesn't really have any sort of in between. It goes straight. It just goes to manic like almost instantly. Like there's not really much of a progression in the character with that kind of stuff. But yeah, as you said, there was a certain times when he would just lose it and you're like, oh okay, people are going to start noticing a bit more now.
Yeah, but then like no one seems to notice or care. Like I suppose the first time we really see the whole thing about the contract escalating is when he's sitting in his office and he's just calling for Alva in gradually increasing tones before going outside into the main office, and he just leaps to the desk and just goes, "There you are!" and proceeds to chase her into a bathroom. Oh, and there's like another woman in the bathroom.
Oh, that's hilarious. That the lady's like, "What are you doing in here?" And but she proceeds, after she's got out of the toilet, she goes up to Alva and asks if she's okay, but doesn't ask if she's okay or try to protect her while Nick Cage is hassling her in the toilet. It was just like, what the hell? Don't leave her in there. This madman is attacking her.
Yeah, and I mean that's the point where we where Alva first mentions that, you know, if you touch me, I'll shoot you. I have a gun, and then a bit later on, he's in like a board meeting with some other, like I suppose the board members or the bosses who we never see from this one scene, and another scene where one of them's in a toilet, so you can't even see his face. But we go to the boardroom and they're all maniacally laughing. And they're maniacally laughing about Nicolas Cage chasing a secretary into the office and into the bathroom, and the audacity of her asking for a raise because Nicolas Cage threatened her and chased her into a bathroom. It's like, and then, again, this is maniacal, over the top, excessive laughter. But when they mention, oh, you know, she really does carry a gun, and then he suddenly stops laughing and starts looking thoughtful, and you're thinking, okay, and they're all still just ridiculously over the top.
So it's like maybe they've all been bloody bitten or something. I don't know. It's like all rubbing off on him or something. But yeah, as you said, what's with everyone laughing in this movie? But yeah, that poor secretary. God, the gun seemed like a good situation for her. But I don't know if that actually was it the next after that where she goes and visits her brother and he wants to give her bullets. And he's like, no, you need normal ones. And no, she goes, no, I want blanks instead. And that kind of ends up being sort of a bit of a plot device for us later. Yeah.
She wanted real bullets, and he's saying, "Oh no, you can't have real bullets. It's bad enough that you carry the gun."
Oh,
and
yeah, it was the other way around. Yeah. That's right. So, and,
but he just says, "Oh, we've only got blanks, but you know, it's enough to scare someone."
Yeah, yeah, and because I think it's around this time too that he starts being even more weird. Like, I think he eats a cockroach. There's a part when he recites the entire alphabet to Alva in the loudest screaming voice. It's just going out of control, this movie.
Oh, you can't gloss over the alphabet part. That's another very famous scene from this movie. And he's talking to his psychiatrist about the fact that the contract wasn't in the right place, and she, the psychiatrist just suggests, oh, someone must have misfiled it. How can you misfile it? It's so easy. It's an alphabetical order. And he just recites the alphabet in this. He goes through the entire alphabet. There's like no need to. I doubt that was even part of the script. I mean, I don't think this is at any point anyone said, you know, Nicholas, that's enough. We just do a few letters.
Yeah.
And then because the psychiatrist can't tell him who misfiled it in the first place, he calls her a bad psychiatrist. And he's going, what does that even mean? I don't know.
Oh, my God.
But then, yeah. I don't know if she is a great psychiatrist, because she pretty much lets him.
Sorry. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't really suggest too much practical to him, or even seem to be addressing the fact that he is just getting more and more manic as everything progresses. Well, no one seems to, aside from Alva, Alva seems to be the only one actually reacting in any way to this increase in just craziness and aggression that he's doing everywhere.
And it's like, it's like every other sort of character fades into the background. Like everyone at work, it just seems to be her with the main sort of problem. But it's hence gives us, I suppose, our lead on for the second half of the movie with the contract. And it almost ends up becoming him and her as you know, the big, big finale. But I don't know if it was around this part, but there's this really strange spot where he was walking home and there's these mimes out the front of his house, the front of his apartment. Oh, did you notice that?
How could you not notice that?
What's that about?
But yeah, so yeah, he walks past his mimes going into his apartment, and his mimes are doing this very bizarre, like almost aggressive, mime act. But there's nobody else there. It's just happening on the sidewalk. And then he goes inside, has a bit of crazy time inside the house, and then comes back out again, and they're doing the exact same thing.
It's just strange, you know. And so I think when he first walked into the apartment after they were doing their first mime bit, there's also two people that walked past him that had feathers in their hat, you know, feathers in their caps. And it was like they were trying to throw in these sight gags or something. That's again where I was sort of wondering if they were trying to do the whole spoof thing, or it was just something I was completely missing. Again, he was probably hallucinating that there were mimes outside his apartment.
I mean, I have a bit of a theory that a lot of the extras were just doing stuff completely over the top, in the vague hope that they would stand out somehow and not just disappear into the background while everyone's looking slack-jawed at Nicolas Cage.
Oh, God, yeah. And I think, and that probably, it probably does help because his performance may have been even more intense and insane if we'd taken some of that funny stuff away.
I don't know, but I did notice, like, I think it was around that time, where he's going in and Jennifer Beale is suddenly there talking to him and whatever, demanding that he say that he love her or whatever. It's her bits kind of just all gel together, really, because it's like, can you turn up, look sexy and bite him? There we go. That's your job done. But the very, very subtle thing is they have an extended shot of the very classic vampire film Nosferatu on the television, which is, you know, quite subtle, and then later on when he's gone full vamp, he's kind of mimicking what was happening on that screen. So I think you mentioned before about the Hunger and the openings being similar, and whether that was some sort of homage or parody or whatever. So I think there are bits in this movie where it tries to acknowledge in some way previous vampire movies to try to increase its vampire cred. Yeah, I don't know if I'm giving it too much credit, but it was kind of the impression that I got.
Yeah, but there's that I suppose also with a lot of these genres too, there's so many iconic, I suppose, tropes about those genres that it would be hard to make a vampire film without including that and that. But I don't think this would have been that smart. I think it is just either trying to probably, yeah, doing the homage / rip-off as much as possible. But yeah, there was a few times like that when I'm, you know, like I really appreciated that kind of stuff, but I think it would have been good to have been kept up the whole way, or a bit more of a spoof. But I think, I don't know, so that we could look at his performance a bit more like a comedy rather than with our jaws on the ground.
Yeah, well, I do think this movie is classified as a black comedy.
But even that sort of, I don't know, it's... obviously, it would be classed as that, but trust me, I wasn't laughing. I was probably laughing more just at the bug-eyed expressions and things like that. So yeah, maybe in that case, maybe they decided to slap a comedy on it because after they saw Nicolas Cage's performance.
Yeah, I guess I can imagine people just say, "What do we do with this? We spent $2 million. We can't just throw it in the bin." And imagine just watching this movie when it gets to the section when Nicolas Cage is in the bathroom at work and suddenly convinces himself that he can't see himself in the mirror, even though, like, we can see his reflection right there. And he starts calling himself a vampire.
Because like, I think he's like, because he has that realization and he's running around going, I'm one of them. And yeah, is that's around the time when he actually goes out and decides to buy some fake fangs, I think, even too. I don't know if it's that, around that spot as well. And it just gets, yeah, weird.
Yeah, he doesn't get the fake teeth straight away. Because that's the only other scene where we get to see one of the other, I suppose, management members who... Well, we get to see the feet of a management member who's in one of the stalls and just tells him to take his rehearsals elsewhere. Again, just like, you know, just shrugging it off almost, the fact that this guy's having a manic episode in the bathroom at work who had previously chased a secretary into a bathroom. And I think after that he goes and terrorizes Elvis some more, so you know, she ends up to the point where she ends up calling in sick the next day because he made her stay back to look for the contract.
But doesn't even, because I think he even, then yeah, he decides to go and, well, I don't know if it's around this time where he dons the Stevie Wonder glasses and decides to go and go to her house and pretty much, like, yeah, so if already we've got sexual harassment, I suppose, with earlier with the toilet, now you've got him stalking her going to her house. It's just, it's not looking good for poor Alva.
Yeah, and then like yeah, he's super duper nice to her and says, "Oh, the contract doesn't really matter, Alva." But like you know, there's not the first time that he was nice to her before going complete bug-eyed crazy again. And as you're just thinking, how many times does this woman need to go through this before taking some sterner actions? Because I'm pretty sure, even in 1988, surely there was someone she could have gone to. You know, even report him to the police, perhaps, which no one ever seems to think of doing in this entire movie. And I'm going to come back to that point.
It seems like she just decided to go to her older brother from New York to help her out with a gun. That seemed to be the next logical step for her. But, well, in her case, she thought that anyway. But, yeah, very very harassment-like. And I don't know if by this stage he'd already got the phone call from the guy going, "Oh, look, there's no rush for the contract." But because he's just so obsessed with it, I don't think he ever actually relays this to her. But you know, obviously she's then stressed and tries to keep finding it.
Yeah, well, she's in the room when he takes that phone call, and then he just says, "As you can see, I couldn't get a word in edgeways."
You did that so well, Trevor.
maybe I can get in some Nicolas Cage
Oh god, but yeah, no, it just seems to be one level of insanity on top of the other the whole way through, and it's just constantly adding the insanity.
but as it particularly those bits with Alva and the contract, as it escalates, he actually does start goading her to use her gun. And particularly when it comes to, I suppose, the big thing where she actually finds the contract, and he just goes, "No, Oliver, it's too late," and proceeds to chase her down the stairs. And she's just there, out of her mind, with a gun out, just going, "Don't hurt me, don't hurt me, don't rape me." And he goes, "I'm going to rape you, Oliver." And I'm thinking, this is just getting super duper icky. And she starts firing at the floor in front of him, just try to scare him. And to the point where, it didn't appear like it was an actual rape scene. I mean, he tore her top and showed her bra, but there didn't seem too much beyond that.
Yeah, it seemed
before he picks up, before he picks up the gun loaded with blanks and puts it in his mouth and fires it twice, which I think is a point where he's completely convinced, and then that's when he goes chopping for teeth.
Because he knows for sure then. But then, you know, I love how, not love, but, you know, it's interesting how the whole thing happened with the blanks. Because I'm like, that really set us up for this. Because, you know, he's now convinced that he's invincible. So, and then the whole buying of the fake fangs. Again, I haven't been saying it, but a lot of these scenes just seem to drag so much because it was just so much. Okay, you've managed to achieve that much in that amount of film when it's really just Nicolas Cage scene stealing or putting fangs in and looking at the mirror very bug-eyed. So I even, you know, I think around sort of about the, I don't know, this is probably past this by now, but even at the 1 hour mark, I'm looking at my watch going, come on. And I think just the craziness, I think I just needed a break, to be honest. So yeah, I just felt around this time, it was really starting to drag because just get to the point. That's what I was feeling like.
Yeah. I know, because he can't afford the very convincing looking stuff, so he gets, you know, the super cheap kids plastic fangs, and and puts them in his mouth. But that's not enough. No, no. He then has to stalk around with them doing a half Nosferatu impersonation. And then he's got to call his psychiatrist and he just goes, can I move my next appointment forward? Yes, I've got a cold. And that's not enough. Then he's got to catch a pigeon, which he then puts in his coat and lurches off with. And I've got to tell you, I think one of the most disturbing things in this movie was the slow pan through his trashed apartment across this trail of feathers before you finally just get to him hunched over, burping, holding his stomach. And you're like, that's just, how could this be one of the most wrong things in this movie? How is it possible for this one thing with a pigeon to just manage to be the thing that it makes me go, what are you doing?
It's like even the birds couldn't get away from his performance. Nothing was safe. Oh yeah, it was just around this point that it was just becoming way too crazy for me. Really, like, he was really taking his acting to the next level. And like, I know early on, I think we saw it twice, but early on he's doing the whole, you know, again, you know, fulfilling the whole vampire trope, but sleeping in a coffin as such. But I think the first time he's under the couch, but by later on it looks like he's actually in a coffin. But no, I think it's just a different couch or something. So he's doing all that kind of stuff as well, which is, I suppose, in many ways, you know, quite funny that he's, you know, going off, as you said, these you know, things that he's seen in this Nosferatu film.
Yeah, I think it was the upturned couch that he used as a coffin. I think he managed to refine it to make it more coffin-like as the movie progressed.
Because I think earlier on he just slides under it.
An upside-down couch. Yeah. but yeah, it has a whole thing where he actually just lifts his couch up, complete with creaking noise, like he was opening a coffin.
little things like that. You're like, yeah, that's quite clever black comedy. That's quite clever homage or parody. But yeah, it's just a shame it didn't maintain a lot of that tone the whole way through. Like, it could have been possibly a lot cleverer of a movie.
Yeah, but I think, yeah, like I said, I mean, there was, obviously you had reached the point before me, and like the pigeon put me right to the edge. But what pushed me over, I think, into I don't know if I can anymore, was, like, you know, he goes to a nightclub, like, they try to stop him getting in, but he just, like, sucker punches the bouncer and barges on through, and he's stalking around with these ridiculous teeth in his mouth, and then he finds just this one woman sitting by herself snorting cocaine in a corner somewhere where there's nobody else around. I don't think plastic teeth could do the amount of damage he did, because he proceeds to, yeah, well, basically bite her on the neck and drink her blood and ends up killing her, and then proceeds to see Jennifer Beale, the real person. Like, he has another vision of Jennifer Beale, the vampire, who just goes, you know, you're pathetic, blah, 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 and then comes across the real girl from earlier and is just demanding everyone to look at her teeth, and he's covered in blood and they kick him out, and he's walking around outside going, I'm a vampire, I'm a vampire, someone, if you got a gun, shoot me, I'll prove it.
Oh, yeah, you're like,
covered in blood.
Look, I've seen some drunk people outside clubs, but I don't think I've ever seen anyone doing that.
yeah, and he's walking through, and then the sun comes up, and he's there going, I'm doomed, but he's not, and he keeps lurching around, and he breaks apart this bit of wood so he can get a wooden stake, and he's telling people to stab him through the heart, covered in blood, and all this is happening. He has that scene where he imagines he's in the psychiatrist's office, and he's just talking crazy, including talking about murdering one woman and raping another on a street corner, covered in blood, holding a sharp, pointy bit of wood in his hand. Why has no one called the police? I refuse to believe that it could go on for that long without one person going, hello, police?
I think there's something not quite right about that guy.
No, that's where this movie, I mean, I was going along, having the ride, I knew it was, like, Nicolas Cage-wise, it was, he's one of his most bizarre performances in this particular movie, but that's what broke me. No one called the police. I just, out of everything else, I could not suspend my disbelief with that.
And the fact, too, it wasn't just a quick scene either. That seemed to go on for ages, that bit when he's just talking there. And I'm like, I'm actually, it was quite quite disturbing. And it's probably a good thing that they didn't. I was going to say, I'm surprised they didn't do a lot of that throughout the movie. But the way it sort of came across, I'm glad they didn't, actually, because it's bizarre. But so that's why I think Alva had to pretty much take it into her own hands, because nobody else saw a thing. That's what it seems to be.
It was only Alva and her brother seemed to be interested in trying to take him down. So, I mean, I suppose we've got to set this up, because we mentioned the imaginary psychiatrist visit, at which point he ends up with an imaginary girlfriend.
That's right,
who
yeah.
he then very, very theatrically and over the top escorts this imaginary woman back to his apartment, where Alva's brother is waiting just outside with a tire iron.
Mm.
And then when he gets to the apartment, he imagines this girl asking him about why he thought he was a vampire. So they have an imaginary fight, and he imaginary kicks her out before apparently having realized he's no longer a vampire, but then still dives back under the upturned sofa coffin. So that's where he is when the brother discovers him.
By this point, I was scratching my head, I do admit.
And the brother goes in there, obviously intending to, you know, beat the crap out of him. But as soon as he sees him, he then holds up his wooden stake, which he's still got, to his chest. And then the brother just hammers down on it for a very sudden and very brutal ending to both Nicolas Cage and the movie. It just kind of stops.
I know, and that's the thing. It's like the brother doing, as you said, like, I think it was quite, yeah, we were sort of thinking innocent, he's just going to beat him up, but yeah, it's, the brother doesn't sort of hesitate to push the stake in, and then it's just kind of over. Like, I know, obviously, it's all about sort of Nick Cage's story, and I suppose once he's died, but yeah, it was such a strange way to end, and almost, poignant's not the word, but it did feel like he went, oh, wow, that was a very brutal way to end this. So instead of the cops actually taking him in, yeah, he just ends up getting killed with a stake. But I'm surprised that his career actually survived this movie afterwards. So obviously the stake didn't go through hard enough.
Yeah, but you probably should check what the gap was between this and his next movie. So I think he had a couple of bit parts, but it was only like another 2 years, 1990. He was in David Lynch's Wild at Heart. So
oh, yeah, and then
I,
he went
I
on
don't
to do
really think it.
He didn't really have time.
He didn't really stop his career.
Yeah, exactly. I think probably based on the amount of money the movie made, only a handful of people seemed to make it. Okay, that's a slight exaggeration, but yeah, I don't think it would have got the audience, and he's probably happy. And I don't even know if he ever speaks of the movie, or if it's known as he hates it or anything. But I'd be very interested to hear his thoughts.
I do believe, actually I forgot to mention this in the trivia, but I do believe he does embrace it. Apparently for the past 4 years, there is a film fest called Caged Forever.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that.
Where they just show Nicolas Cage movies. And this particular year, it was the fourth year of it, and Nicolas Cage finally accepted the open invitation to turn up.
Oh, that's awesome.
I did hear he did a live recital of Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart, and I had heard audio of the end, of the climax of that story, and let's just say I can definitely draw a parallel between that and what we watched in this movie.
It might actually put a bit more into context, actually. So, oh, it's good to know he embraces it. And I think, I don't know, knowing sort of the, I don't know, in many ways, Nick Cage has become, I suppose, not a caricature, but I like to use the word, he's become a meme, pretty much, with a lot of his films, and sort of now becoming such an action star. But, you know, it's good to see that this film... that he did it, you know. It's good to sort of see another side to him, and actually to see how, as I said earlier, that he actually has aged very well, considering it's been almost 30 years.
He has. Yep. And look, straight up, there are a lot of Nicolas Cage movies that I quite like him in. I actually saw him most recently, I saw Snowden, the biopic Snowden.
Yeah. And I haven't actually seen that yet.
Yeah, he doesn't play a major role, but he turns up and he's in there, and he is excellent. So, you know, there's no doubting that the guy can act. I think it's just a matter of limiting his choices. But again, I think we're jumping ahead.
Yeah, of course.
was there any other particular parts from the movie you wanted to bring up that are weighing on your mind?
Oh, probably just, I love, and this might have to be beeped out, but I just love how the ending is pretty much just Nicolas Cage losing his shit. That's what I've got in my notes here, and that's what it felt like trying to watch this, but I had to laugh. You got to love it, a paper from 1988. I think it was after the night when he goes to the club and tries to look at the girl's teeth. And I love how the front page of the newspaper was Disco Death. And I'm like, oh, my God, that is the best name for a band, or some sort of goth night or something. But, I thought that was quite funny. I don't think we'd see a headline like that on a paper now. Ah, the 80s. But actually, talking about the nightclub scenes, it was so funny. Like, when you see any of these sort of 80s films, they all have that same look and that same soundtrack that just is so quintessentially 80s, and that's one thing I noticed a lot about this movie too. So I was glad that it still felt very much of the era.
But yeah, but now that you mentioned the newspaper, like, they had this big headline, Disco Death, and they had a massive photo of the woman with the neck wound. I mean, that would never be on the front page of a newspaper.
I know, it's ridiculous. But I must admit, it was pretty funny, like, even though he's essentially attacking her, but it was pretty funny seeing him just trying to show this woman's teeth to everybody in the nightclub. It's just one of those bizarre scenes. You're like, oh my gosh. Only in this movie, yeah. I suppose.
Only in this movie. Well,
but yeah, that's probably my main points about the actual plot itself. So nothing else sort of stands out aside from the fact that it was bad crazy. And there's probably many other things that I noticed that I have forgotten to mention.
And that's quite all right. Well, on that note then, I suppose now comes the time. I mean, I chose this movie, Christian, so as per Rufus Project edition, please go first. Was there anything redeeming in this movie, and was it redeemable overall?
Gosh, now, Trevor, okay, always going first. Well, I can't exactly copy any of your response now, can I? So I have to be able to go into this completely with my opinion. But look, I wanted to like this movie, and like I always say, you want to give these films a go and think about the context and the history that they came out, blah, 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 blah. Blah, 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 sorry, but I actually watched this with a friend as well, and they actually turned to me afterwards and said, how did Nicolas Cage have a career after this? And I think that line sums up so much about this movie. You need to see it. You need to experience it, especially if you're a Nicolas Cage fan, but you do need to see this film for its performance, because his performance is absolutely crazy. But in terms of... Okay, I've gone off on a tangent, but in terms of redeeming features, look... Yeah, look, it's kind of really hard. Probably the closest thing... It almost reminded me... his performance reminded me a bit of Jack Nicholson in The Shining, and I love his performance in that movie, and I love that movie, but that real sort of... He was almost so crazy before he even got the bite, so I think Nicolas Cage was doing also almost a Faye Dunaway in Mummy Dearest and just trying to chew the scenery up as much as possible. But, look, I'm struggling here to find redeeming features. 1 hour it got to, and it was dragging, and I still had 43 minutes to go. Were they going for, as we said, a homage or a parody, or were they really trying to make an erotic-style vampire film, and it just completely didn't work? Jennifer Beals was wasted, not literally, but I bet she wishes she was. But she was very awkward in this movie, and it really was just I'd love to say a vehicle for Nick Cage, but well, a vehicle for Nick Cage just to go absolutely crazy. And I think it's all actors need to have an odd film in their filmography, and I think this is definitely it. He did some of the worst acting I think I've ever seen in a movie, and this, just the sight of Nicolas Cage with a bloody shirt running around New York is just. Yeah, that's the stuff of memes or stuff of legends. But Trevor, yeah, I'm even rummaging through the pages of my notes going, no, I don't have any redeeming features. I don't think I found one. So I'm going to have to say it's irredeemable. I echo what that review said earlier. You want to sort of watch it for the bad movie with the group of friends, but you'd be bored and also quite, I don't know, it's quite strange. So yeah, I do not feel this film is redeemable, even though I wanted to make sure it was, but unfortunately, no.
That is fine. That is fine. And you definitely touched on some of the points, I guess, that I'm looking at. But first up, look, if there was ever a masterclass of how to go completely over the top, this is it. And it's not just Nicolas Cage, like I mentioned before. Like, you got all these extras in there just going completely over the top and just so exaggerated. And the manic laughing, just stop it, please.
Oh, yes.
But to me, it is a complete mystery how anyone would have said to Nicolas Cage and just went, yep, that's just what this scene needs. But then, I mean, I don't know if this is redeemable or not, but it is strangely compelling. I mean, really, I was dragged through it just more out of sheer morbid curiosity of what was going to happen next and what Cage was going to do next. And you really can't dispute the fact that Cage fully committed to the role. So even though it is a terrible performance, the fact is he kept it up and he stayed focused on it for the entire thing, which, if anything, I think does show that he is a good actor in some weird, bizarre, turnabout-y way. Look, I would suggest watching this movie to see just how far Nicolas Cage is willing to go, or even to see the birth of all the Cage memes, but only watch it once, because at the end of the day, this movie is terrible. So, and unless you like seeing the Rage Cage let loose, then, you know, if you're a big fan of that, then you probably already have seen this movie and love it, if that's your thing. So, I mean, look, it really was a bit of a tough choice. I know it's a bad movie, but yet I was strangely fascinated by it. But look, at the end of the day, I do have to say that this movie was not redeemable.
Oh, we tried. Oh, gosh, we don't seem to be having much luck this year, do we?
Well, I mean, look, we do tend to pick. I mean, this podcast is meant to be a challenge. I mean, I know occasionally I go with the guilty pleasure, and I always feel a bit like I'm cheating a bit when I do that. But you know, if we can't redeem it, we can't redeem it, and that's okay. You know.
Yeah, and hey, and as you said, like if you want to see where all these memes come, or want to see Nicolas Cage rage or acting like he's had too many Red Bulls, you really can't go much further than this one. But yeah, that doesn't necessarily make it redeemable.
Absolutely not. Now, you know, well, we didn't like it. Obviously, we said it's not redeemable. We've actually got a listener comment on this one as well. We had Leah, who got in touch with us through the Facebook page. Thank you, Leah. Much appreciated. And his thoughts were a bunch of Cage's crazy moments after he gets bitten by Jennifer Beals is what I feel is definitely the more redeeming aspect about the film.
Ah, yes.
He's a fan of Crazy Cage.
Oh, good. And we always welcome feedback from people, so it's good to know there's some fans out there for Vampire's Kiss.
And that's quite all right. And you know what? There are some big, big fans out there. Now, just because we can't redeem the movie doesn't mean there's not somebody out there who is a fan of the movie. And I do like to finish off on a redeeming note, whether or not we could redeem it. So I've gone back to Amazon, and I've dug up another review, which I think really sums up the feelings of fans of this movie. The title of this review is Hurts So Good. Painfully awesome. One of Nick Cage's worst slash best performances ever. Everything about this movie is absurd. Then in all in caps, absurd! It's like watching two dogs making love. You'll want to look away, but you can't. Or maybe you don't want to look away. Maybe you want to keep watching and watching and watching. This movie is so bad slash awesome that you'll feel dirty just watching it. But it's so good, it's better than Titanic. 5 stars.
Oh, well, I don't think Titanic and Vampire's Kiss have ever been compared before, but interesting. Oh, good. Okay, it's good to see a different perspective as well. So they're going with a so bad it's good sort of angle, I think.
Pretty much. I don't think anyone's ever going to call this a good movie.
Well, I was even surprised earlier on when you said it was like it was rated 5 point something on IMDb. I'm still baffled by that.
I think it really comes down to how much you enjoy watching Nicolas Cage be, as you said, crazy.
Yeah, that sums it up perfectly.
So, there you go. We couldn't redeem this one, but if you are a fan, good luck to you. Yeah, so that's 3 for 3, Christian. We managed to redeem one yet so far. I wonder if there's anything we could consider for next time.
We might have to bring out some. I don't know. Well, I've got a few different options, Trevor. I don't want to give the title away, but let's just say you made a Titanic reference before, and I'm like, no, I'll keep that in the back of my mind for later in the year. But look, I had a few titles in mind, and as always, I like to throw some retro in there, throw a bit of, you know, some musicals, throw some sequels. But I actually thought, I was looking actually at my DVD cabinet earlier, and I'm like, oh, there's one particular DVD that stuck out to me that I think I bought for about 50 cents a cash converters that I'd never seen. It's this iconic. It's sort of in the realm of Howard the Duck bad in terms of a film. And I thought, okay, maybe it's time that we looked at this film. So I didn't realise it was actually from the same year as Vampire's Kiss. So we might be doing an equally dodgy movie from 1988, depending on what we come up with. But we're going to look at the infamous Mac and Me, which I know nothing about. But as I said, the DVD was staring right at me. And it's supposedly one of the worst movies ever made and one of the worst rip-offs of E.T. ever made. Ooh, a cheap E.T. I can only imagine how bad it could be. So we're going to watch Mac and Me from 1988, the American science fiction adventure film.
Lovely. I have heard stories about it.
Yes.
But never have felt compelled to watch it. But now I get to.
See, I buy these terrible DVDs when I see them cheap because I know one day we're going to get to them. So now's our chance. So I look forward to, and obviously look forward to hearing anybody else's opinions that I may have seen at Mac and Me as well. From what I've heard, it's didn't probably get a very big release out here, so I don't know if it's quite known out here, but we shall definitely tackle it and let everybody know what it's like.
Mm-hmm. And if anybody out there wants to check out the movie before our next podcast, I've just got to say, you're going to have to source it yourself, because I've just done a quick check, and it's not on any of the Australian streaming services.
Oh, so maybe that DVD might come in handy.
It might. I may need to get you to flick it over to me at some point as well.
You might be, depending on what the film's like, Trevor, you might be able to keep the DVD too.
Oh, lovely. Or maybe I can find it for 50 cents a cash converter. Who knows?
Anyway, we don't want to curse this movie before we've watched it. But yes, we'd love to hear anybody's feedback and whether they've seen Mac and Me or have some ideas about that, or have seen Vampire's Kiss and might think that we were, I suppose, a bit harsh, and we might have been a bit harsh, but I thought in many cases it deserved it.
Absolutely. And yeah, definitely let us know. It's actually really, really easy to get in touch with us. You can head to rufusproject.com and leave comments below this very, very episode. You can be like Leo and head to the Rufus Project Facebook page, leave a comment there. We're also on Twitter, or you can even send us an email to podcast at rufusproject.com. Also, if you are listening through iTunes or one of the various podcasting apps out there, then please rate and review us, because that would be super duper keen. And we've just started a new season, so if we can get out there, there's a big backlog for anyone who discovers us to really get their teeth into. So we definitely love to have our podcast spread wide and far.
Definitely. And I believe there's also, in between weeks, there's also the What the History podcast. Here we go, another subtle plug for Trevor and Susie's podcast. So listeners, I love listening to it, and I definitely recommend you getting on board. So it's our sister podcast, but by no means less important.
Absolutely. The What the History podcast, available at wth.rufusproject.com. Again, another one that could be great to be shared around. Actually, recently had our 10th episode, so that was very, very exciting. But Christian, do you have anything that you would like to plug from yourself?
There's always many Christian Fletcher events coming up. We've got a George Michael Dead or Alive video night on the 24th of February at the Globe. We also have an ABBA in Australia 40th anniversary, Comedy Commentary Cinemas back, Roaring 20 Cinemas back. We're doing Princess Bride, Dirty Dancing, Monty Python Double. So, as always, there's way too many to mention on here. So head to ChristianFletcher.com or Christian Fletcher Events on Facebook.
Absolutely. I think I'm going to make sure I get along to some of those myself. Always fun.
Definitely. A lot better than some of the movies we watch here.
Absolutely. And but look, hey, look, we may not have redeemed the movie. We may not have redeemed Vampire's Kiss, but I really enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, definitely. And I'm going to look forward to looking at many memes of Nicolas Cage from this movie from now on and actually understand what people are talking about.
It's an education in that respect, though. You can't say that.
So there you go. A Rufus Project is also educational.
Who knew? Well, in that case, I think there's nothing else to say until next time, when we come back to discuss Mac and Me from 1988.
Yes.
I can't believe I'm going to watch that. I guess until then, see you next time.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Trevor.
Hi, kids. It's me, Ronald McDonald, and I'm on the set of my very first motion picture ever. It's a movie called Mac and Me, and it stars my little friend from outer space here. His name is Mac, and I want to introduce you to him. Mac? Anybody seen Mac? Where'd he go?
Paging Ronald McDonald.
Well, listen, I've got to go now.
You're wanted in makeup.
Makeup? Me?
They were an average alien family living on their own planet. And we were an average family living on ours.
He took my Coke, Mom.
Come on, you guys.
I don't have it. I didn't take it.
I knew it!
Accidents happen, and like us, they found themselves in a strange new neighborhood.
I like it.
Me too.
Shh. Communing with the Earth spirits.
Welcome to California, bud.
Alert, alert. We have a malfunction. We have a malfunction.
Their lives were in danger.
Back off, Larry. Get away from it. Now, you got a problem here.
They had to escape.
We see him.
When the smoke cleared, their family was separated. Somehow, one of the aliens was hiding in our house. Government wanted to capture him.
It's here.
Everyone was after him.
John!
And my brother, Eric, wants to make friends.
We got him! Get him!
Turn it off!
You sucked this living thing into a vacuum cleaner?
Yeah, and then we blew him out again.
Now Eric is risking not only his life, but my life.
Give me the gun. Step back!
To save them.
This is the police.
There he is!
I told you they don't understand.
It's about more than friendship. It's about adventure. Mac and Me.
Is it too good to be bad? So bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad. I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy. Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. I'm the B, says it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy. Oh boy.
Redeeming features.